Looking for the perfect gift this season? Want to avoid the malls and lines this year? Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks and how, for only $49.99, you can get my family gift pack when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter the code BONES in the search bar. That's 77% off. For less than $50, you get two filet mignons, two top sirloins, two boneless pork chops, four boneless chicken breasts, four kielbasa sausages, four burgers, a 12-ounce package of all-beef meatballs, four potatoes au gratin, four caramel apple tartlets, one Omaha steak seasoning packet, plus get four additional kielbasa sausages free. All of this for less than $50. If you're looking for convenient and quick shopping for those on your list, go to omahasteaks.com. Enter the code BONES in the search bar, add the family gift pack to your cart, and get a 77% savings. It's the gift guaranteed to be a hit.
All right, welcome to episode 25 of the Bobbycast. All right, and today with songwriter Lee Thomas Miller, known to his friends as Lee Miller, but I guess Lee Miller was too generic. You had to put Thomas so they would know.
My mother never, ever called me Lee. She called me Lee Thomas, one word.
Oh, so should I call you Lee Thomas?
If you had ever met my mother, you would call me Lee Thomas without realizing it, because she always did.
Oh, I see. When I would Google Lee Miller, it was always like ancient Civil War heroes or some guy that was in three episodes of Jurassic Park, the cartoon. You know, it's
some famous British photographer lady, too.
I want to play a few just before we get started so we can have an idea. Here's some of the songs, and we'll get to them during the conversation that Lee has written. Do you know how, before I say it, do you know how many number ones you've written?
Seven.
Okay. Is that true, Mike? Is that the fact check?
Yeah, seven.
All right, seven. Okay, so, for example...
It's going to be fact-checking.
Oh, yeah. We have lots of fact checks. Like a couple of kids just trying In Color by Jamie Johnson. You should have seen it in color. Southern Girl, Tim McGraw. Kisses sweeter than Tupelo, honey. Little bit crazy like New Orleans. Memphis Blue and Daytona Sunny. You're going to miss this? You're going to miss this. You're going to want this back. You're going to wish these days. Just a few of the songs that Lee has written. Also, The World by Brad Paisley. Perfect Storm. She destroys me in that t-shirt. And I love her. And I'm Still a Guy. But remember, I'm still a guy. All right, so you have quite the library of songs there. I like to start by letting people know the big picture first.
Okay.
So when you first came to Nashville, you came to Nashville, true or false, because your goal was to play in Alabama.
No, I tell this story, and they always retell it wrong. I always say I wanted to be in whatever the next Alabama-type thing was, because they were my heroes.
What was the Alabama-type thing? You mean a band?
A band, and, you know... They were cool, and there was a guy on the end that played a bunch of instruments. I wanted to be the guy in the modern version of Alabama, whatever it was, that had all the instruments set up and played a little bit of this and played a little bit of that. And that was the goal.
So your goal was never to be the front man of even the new Alabama?
No.
You wanted to be the utility player?
I always wanted to be the utility player.
So you came to
But
town.
I wanted to be in a traveling, signed band. Like the Eagles or something like that, whatever. But whatever it was. I mean, in the '80s, the early '80s, you know, I'm just Alabama made me want to be in the business, and so that's why the Alabama reference keeps popping up.
So okay, so you did not want to be in Alabama, but you wanted to be in something like Alabama.
Exactly.
Okay. Did you have a band like Alabama? I mean, did you have a band called
from high school,
Kentucky Brothers? Or?
From high school, from the time I was in middle school, there was some incarnation of dudes that could or couldn't play in my parents' living room trying to learn how to be. Yeah.
So you moved to Nashville wanting to be the person on stage. Were you not good enough?
Well, you know, back home in Kentucky, I was pretty good. and you grow up in these bars and especially when you're young and you can kind of play different instruments, people say, "Oh, you're fantastic." And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm fantastic." But, you know, I think in high school, I made my first visit to Nashville. And Nashville was a lot different then. There weren't near as many honky-tonks as there are now. But there would be kind of local clubs where, you know, the people that had moved to town trying to get heard would go play. And I remember I would go and I would... And at the time, you know, I went on to music school. I was classically trained. But through these years, while I'm trying to figure out how to be a better musician, I would come here and I would go in these clubs and I would sit there and I would listen to these guys that weren't working. They were trying to get gigs. And I would sit there and go, you know.
Because they were so good.
They were so good. Yeah. They were so freakishly good on every instrument, whatever it was. Whatever they said and did, it was just like, and this guy is unemployed here. Back where I'm from, this guy would be, you know, a legend.
King Ding-a-ling.
You know. But so, you know, I didn't come here with any, you know, false hopes. I knew what I was getting myself into.
So you moved to town, and you get into kind of a band playing fiddle, and they fire you. Is that true?
Well, so I look at whatever I played at the time, and I said, okay, certainly guitar players are a dime a dozen in this town. And but at that point, piano was my first instrument, but I really felt like as far as, you know, I probably wasn't ever going to be up to par with these guys. So I said, okay, I'll be a fiddle player. So that became all my focus. And so I moved here, and I moved here on June 1st. And 2 weeks later, I'd already met somebody. They got me an audition for Tom T. Hall. And so I walked into the audition. Tom wasn't there. It was with the band leader. And I auditioned for Tom T. Hall, and the guy hired me. And there were two fiddle players. And so I get the job playing one. He asked me to come back and run through the whole set with the second guy, and so I went back, and the other guy had been there for a while. So I in my second audition, I'm now playing all of the music with the second chair. And okay, good, you're hired. We leave Saturday. So July 3rd, I get on the bus as Tom T. Hall's fiddle player, and we did two dates, and on July 5th, he fired me.
So why did he fire you? What did they say to you? Because he didn't even give you a chance. Like,
well, so we get on the bus and we drive to Homestead, Florida. Well, I've never been on a bus. You know, so I'm 21, I guess. And I get on the bus and it's like seasoned musicians. Tom's not there. And Tom was from about 70 miles in Kentucky, from where I'm from. So I'm thinking, first of all, I've got the Kentucky thing in my back pocket. I'm going to woo him. He's going to love me, you know. So we get on the bus to go to Florida, and there's no Tom. It's just the band. And so I meet the band. And, well, these guys were seasoned road guys. And they really weren't all into the new guy, right? So I didn't really have a friend. And so we drive to the other side of the world, and we get there, and there's no Tom. We do sound check, and there's no Tom. And when I come back, Tom has arrived. And so I introduce myself to Tom. Well, Tom isn't a real people person. Tom isn't a chatter. And I told him who I was. I told him where I was from. And he just kind of looked through me, said nothing. And that was that. And okay, so now I'm nervous. And so the band leader started getting anxious because he realized he had hired me. Nobody else had heard me. What if I mess up? And the Tom T. Hall gig was pretty fiddle heavy. And so he starts saying, "Hey, man, it's kind of my gig here. You know, it's my butt. Don't mess this up." Okay. So this went on kind of for 6 hours. We do the first gig, and I rush over to him, and I'm like, "How'd I do?" And he says, "Monitors weren't very good. I couldn't hear you. I'll have to listen tomorrow." So we go from there to North Carolina, and he just went, he's like, "Man," he says, "I just, you know, you got to do that, man. You got to be great, man. You got to be. And it's gotten in my head, and we get ready to kick off the show, and I'm trembly. And I'm nervous. "Ladies and gentlemen, Tom T. Hall." And the worst fiddle player in America shows up. I mean, I absolutely. And as a matter of fact, the guy that was playing with me is going, "What's wrong?" And I'm like, "Shut up." You know? And it was like a cat fight. And it just kept getting worse. And I'm like a little anxiety attack, a little panic attack. And the more I played, the worse I got. And Was it?
They didn't see enough in you, though, to try again.
Fired me. Fired me.
I mean, I've had some people come work for me that I'm like, you know what? You're not that good now, but I see a lot in you. There's a lot of potential.
Fired me, and it was about 5 or 6 years ago before I ever saw Tom T. Hall again. And we were at some function, and I went up to him, and I said, Mr. Hall, I'm Lee Miller. I played fiddle for you for 3 days in 1991, and you fired me. And he says, what happened? And I said, I wasn't ready. And he was kind of like, are you mad at me? And I'm like, no, it was the greatest thing that ever happened. It changed my path. Can I have a picture? So that's where that was my welcome to Nashville, kid.
So your path has changed because your confidence is broken. You're now the broken stallion.
Sure.
And so do you put it in your head, okay, I'm just going to write. I'm staying in town, but I'm going to write.
No, I bared down. I was like, let's get on with it. So, you know, I'm the guy that rehearsed or practiced 15 hours a day. I mean, I played and practiced and practiced and took lessons and practiced and did more auditions and, you know, did local gigs, road gigs with touring bands and did whatever I had to do.
So you stayed on the road and played instruments?
Not with anybody you would know, just with bar bands, but whoever, I mean, I had to pay bills, sure. So I would do, and again, I was the utility guy, so I would play everything, you know, and I had tons of gear, and I would do whatever, and somebody heard me and put me with a producer, had this duo and made it a trio, and they wanted to try to get a record deal, and...
That was Sugarland.
And, well, it wasn't, no, it never got to Sugarland level, but what it is, we started writing songs every day, and writing a project and then auditioning for labels and all that kind of stuff. And that got me writing on Music Row, and I met more people. And music in the 90s was huge. Music Row was amazing. There were so many record companies and so many records being made and so many publishers and writing, you know, signing lots of writers. And the key was I started writing with Music Row guys, and people were giving me a chance. And in 96, a guy named Jeff Carlton ran this big independent company, and a buddy of mine had got me in there writing with some of their guys, and he said I don't think you can do any of this other stuff. He said, I think you could be a full-time songwriter. I said, okay, done. And he signed me.
So you signed to be a full-time songwriter. How long from that day until you got your first cut?
The first cut was probably, I don't know, within a couple of years. I mean, this company was really great. The people that were mentoring me were really great. And we the whole key was, first of all, I have to be writing in the ballpark of what's working. You know, that's what's legitimately commercial music. Then you got to have somebody that can legitimately get it listened to. And that's where they came in, and they could. So you would get good listens immediately. And, you know, there were several cuts that came pretty quick. It took a while to have a hit, but, you know, you got to have the cut before you can have a hit.
First hit was?
First bona fide hit was The Impossible with Joe Nichols.
Unsinkable ships sink, unbreakable walls break. Sometimes the things you think never happen, happen just like that. Unbendable speed.
So you write the song. Who'd you write it with?
Kelly Lovelace.
So you guys write this. Is this one of those where they say, oh, you knew the magic was there as soon as you wrote the song?
So Kelly Lovelace, it was a blind date. I didn't know him. He didn't know me. Publishers put us in a room together, and we wrote this song, and I did the demo on the song and turned it in.
Which means you sang it and the demos.
No. I heard a guy sing it.
Oh, you heard something else? Yeah. Okay.
Unsinkable ships.
And we turn it in. And everybody just kind of said, that's nice. And I don't know how much it was pitched. It wasn't pitched much. And so I'd even gone to RCA because I had a friend that was an A&R, and I took it to him. And the only person I ever knew that loved it was this A&R guy. And he held it and for a few weeks and played it for people at the label. And then one day he called me and said, I've played it for everybody here. Everybody we have on the roster, everyone's passed. So I'm going to have to let it go. And this song was never mentioned for maybe 8 or 9 more months.
So it just disappears into song purgatory.
Well, you know, here's the thing. There's everyone's excited about the new songs. So they love it, and they go, you pitch it to everybody that's looking today. And in a couple weeks, there's a new batch of songs, and the publishers are pitching those songs. And it just kind of got buried. And I mean, honestly, I don't think that the publishers were that excited about it.
So then how does it get refound and reused again?
Well, this one got lucky because Kelly's publisher was a big publisher at the time. And people, this song's meant a lot to a lot of people. And people will say, this must have been undeniable. And I say, oh, are you kidding me? It was quite deniable. It was kind of over in this B drawer at their publishing company, to the point that there was a guy named Brent Rowan that was cutting sides on this young guy who had already lost one record deal named Joe Nichols. And he asked somebody at EMI for some songs just so they could maybe do some demos. And this is one of the songs that they let him have just to cut sides on somebody that had already lost one record deal. This was way down the food chain, right? And so they went and did a real low-budget demo and then called and said, hey, so they really like this song. And I'm like, well, who is it? And so they tell me, and it was so far removed from, you know, actually even a record deal. I'm like, okay, well, thanks. And then they said, okay, we think there's going to be a new record label. The guy that had made Arista Records famous and signed tons of people, Tim DuBois, responsible for all these major acts, is doing, we think, is going to have a new record label with Tony Brown, who's one of the biggest producers in Nashville history. They're going to be partners. We think they're going to have a label, and if they do, we think they're going to sign Joe Nichols, and we think they like your song.
It's a lot of thinks to have to fall into
place. No, you don't even, you know, as somebody said, you know, it's a single for an artist that hasn't been signed to a record label that doesn't exist. So no, we thought nothing about this. And then, honestly, it comes out, and you're like, okay, well, right before it comes out, Mark Chestnut cuts it. And he was on Sony, and it was still Mark Chestnut, you know. And I'm like, woohoo, this is a big cut. And my publisher said, well, we promised it to Joe Nichols. And I said, Joe Nichols doesn't even have a record deal. And it's a relationship town. And Tim DuBois, who's one of all of our heroes, he had actually come to my publisher and said, you can't take this song away from me. You promised it to me. And I'm sitting there going, you all have all lost your mind. I said, we don't even know if this guy has a record deal, you know? And they said, well, we're going to have to honor it. So then, okay. And so we just waited to see. Okay, well, the word came, there is a record label. There is a record deal. They're going to try to put this out. And it was that day that I'm like, you know what? I don't know anything about the music business. And I remember I'd had a song on a Blackhawk that I really loved called Days of America, and it had gone to 33.
These are the days of America, brother to brother.
Queued up that fast.
Don't worry about it.
Are you that good?
Don't worry about what we got over here.
That's unbelievable.
So as you were saying, Black Hawk, Days of America.
And we were so pumped because this was kind of my tribute to 9/11. That's what we wrote after 9/11, and I love this record. And I remember they did it at halftime of the Titans Steelers game in Pittsburgh. And I'd actually gone up there to see this happen. It was a big deal. And then it stopped at 33, and I'm like, it was disappointing, but it was the biggest record I'd ever had. And so Impossible comes out, and as always, new artists, you know, they climb slow. And I was sitting in my office, and my publisher opened the door, and like every Monday, you kind of know what the charts have done for the week. You kind of get through the weekend, and then Monday morning they say, this is the official new charts. And I'll never forget, she opened the door, and she says, you went to 19. And that was the first time that I went, oh, that's a hit.
Because of the top 20 song.
I guess. There was no rule. Just to me, I was like, oh, 19, you know. And it kept climbing and it kept climbing and it was at 5. And it was the anniversary of 9/11. Whatever anniversary that was. Whatever the year. It was 9/11. It was like 2001 or 2002, I guess. And we probably were out of juice. We weren't going to make it to number one, but we'd gone to 5. And on the anniversary of 9/11, as radio does, they're playing things that are appropriate for the emotion for 9/11. And the song that was going to keep us out was 10 More Rounds of Jose Cuervo.
Which is the opposite of what radio was
playing. It was teed up to go number one.
Yeah.
And we jumped from 5 to 1 because we got enough emotional spins because of the day to put us over the thing. Now, in all fairness, 10 Rounds of Jose Cuervo went number one the next week. We didn't keep them out, but it allowed us to get number one.
Crazy.
Unsinkable ships.
A non-signed artist on a label that didn't exist cuts a song. It wasn't even going to be number one. And there you go. So did that change it all for you when you have a number one? Do you have a lot more clout? Is it like everybody wants to write with you now?
Well, I think it makes people take notice. Like, we all are aware of what's number one. And if it's somebody that's never had one before, everybody's like, oh, that's cool. It's like, I think everybody loves to see somebody new win. I think that it makes people pay attention. The most beautiful thing is because as we all do our own self-doubting, and I'm a one-hit wonder. A few months later, I had a number one on Terry Clark called I Just Want to Be Mad. I'll never leave, I'll never stray.
My love for you will never change. Continue on.
And what was fun is because for me, it was emotional because I'm like, okay. Even for me, I'm like, okay, I did it again.
You're not Chumbawamba at this point.
Yeah. It was some confidence, you know. And there was a lot of things going on then. I mean, it's like we had, you know, several things that we thought were going to happen and then didn't. But those two things did kind of back to back. And, yeah, I think that changed everything. It got me in writing rooms that I couldn't get in before.
So Joe Nichols, The Impossible, is the number one. Terry Clark, I Just Want to Be Mad, is now at number one. Run your fingers through my hair. And your list of number ones, what's next? Chronologically.
I think The World would have been next.
So The World with Brad, which is a whole sidebar subject, but... Honey, all I got to say is to the world. You may be just another girl.
But to me, maybe you are the world.
So you and Brad have a relationship where you guys have written a lot of songs together.
Yeah.
And so, because knowing both of you guys, I see how you get along because you guys have the same sense of humor.
Is that good?
Well, I think you and I have the same sense of humor, too. And I think
is
that's
that good?
No, it's not. It's not good for anybody except us because nobody else thinks we're funny. And we've seen that in rooms where we're the only two in the room that think we're funny. But you and Brad, is that what makes you guys tick at first? Because you both have that dry, sarcastic, witty, plus you're good songwriters.
I don't know. You'd have to ask him. I've known him so long. I knew him before his first record came out. We wrote the first time back then. And I didn't... matter of fact, The World was the first cut that I had on him. And I had a couple on that same album. And again... You know, it's about relationships. I mean, from there, we end up spending more time together, and we've been writing ever since then.
But you like each other, and you don't time together unless you like each other.
No, we do. And again, I can't speak for him. I know that there's something familiar about knowing somebody for so long, and, you know, I always say the music community is tight. So the people that you're close to, we all do life together, and we all, you know, the goods, the bads. You know, he's one of those people that, I mean, Brad's interesting in that Brad's a talker. Brad likes to sit and talk stuff out and just hang. More so than any guy in my life, Brad is all about, if he's going to relax, if he's just going to blow off steam, we're just going somewhere, we're just going to hang. We're going to sit, we're going to chat, we're going to laugh, we're going to listen to music, we're going to drive around, you know, and just hang, you know. So... Yeah, it's like you spend enough time with somebody, you know somebody pretty well. And then he's incredibly loyal to everyone in his world. I mean, his crew, you know, the bus drivers, everyone in Brad Paisley land has been there. I mean, sometimes we say, what do you got to do to get fired by Brad Paisley? I mean, he truly loves his people and he wants you there. And so he doesn't write unless he's working on an album. So we're just hanging unless it's time to do an album. And if it's time to do an album, and then we write, and it's intense. It's all day and all night and all week and all month, and you just slam it out and you spend a lot of time together.
You Write the World. Was that the first track off the record?
No, I don't. No, it wasn't. There were several singles in. I mean, again.
Can you pressure a friend to put your track out first?
No. No, as a matter of fact, you kind of. I think you have to be careful. And there's an art to that. It's like, I'm really bad at self-promotion anyway. But if I'm sitting here and there's a conversation about the next single is going to be my song or somebody else's song, I'm going to be thinking, I love you so much, please put mine out. But I'm never, ever, ever, ever probably going to bring it up or ask what he's thinking because I feel like it puts him in an uncomfortable position.
So The World is the number one song. That's your number three. What's number four?
I guess Still a Guy.
See, this is how you know you're a great writer, when you can't remember the order of your number ones.
Well, time kind of gets funky and hazy. And
problems. Oh, man.
But remember, I'm still a guy.
When I hear this song, I think of both of you guys' personalities in this. Like, I hear it, and by knowing you guys, like, this is the quintessential song where both of you guys get together and make a bunch of jokes, and a song comes out of it.
Well, the common denominator about all of your first four is Kelly Lovelace. I wrote the first two that you played with just me and him, and then these two Brad things are me, Brad, and Kelly. And I mean, I think, again, it's also knowing somebody, you know? We were having this conversation, Kelly and I, about Brad and Kim, and, you know, it's this perfect, amazing relationship, these two beautiful people with these beautiful lives, and he's a country superstar and she's a movie star. And they're so happy. And you start saying, like I said to Kelly, I said, do you think when nobody's around, they just have redneck fights just like everybody else? Just ugly, nasty, married fights. And Kelly said, I don't know. They seem pretty stable. He probably annoys her. He's still a guy. And that's where the idea came from. So I said, well, how would you write that? And so we kind of roughed in some thoughts on it and took it to him. And he liked it, but it took a long time to get it. He's kind of got to finally find an emotional connection to it. And when he finally did, when he finally thought it was funny, he got it to where he thought it was funny, then the question was, how far do we go? And so then we took it farther than we probably should have. And then that's when he decided it was perfect. And we felt like it was uncommercial. We felt like it would scare the label. And the label felt like it would absolutely reach people, and they were right, and I'm glad they were.
Does that song surprise you most? That's one of your number ones? Of all of them.
You know, only maybe, but remember, you know, your opinion is kind of influenced by what your peers say, and I felt like that, oddly enough, this song probably, from my friends, my writer friends, they probably gave this song more love than the others because they felt like it was written so well. Just strictly based on a well-written song. Now, the thing that is interesting is it's been a while since anything this, quote, funny was a hit. It's like radio doesn't really do funny lately. So sometimes it shocks me that something this light and this silly and this, you know.
He was a superstar then, though, right, at this point?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
It's easier to be a little funny and have a levity when you're a superstar.
And he had been funny enough. Alcohol was funny. Celebrity. He had done this before. It was kind of his thing, you know, and it had been a little while, so it was kind of ready for it. But, like, he would test it at shows. And, of course, like I said, he's been an arena act for a long time. And so before anybody had heard it, he would sit on a stool with an acoustic and he would sing it to them in an arena, which is gutsy. And he was blown away because he said the entire place just roared and laughed, which he says, that's fantastic, because they don't know the song. You're selling it like that. And then we remember that he started getting nervous right before it came out as a single, because the album had been out for a while. This wasn't the first single. It was several singles in. So people, his fans had the album and they knew the music. And I remember one day he'd said, they're not really laughing anymore. And then Kelly pointed out, he says, no. Because they're singing. You know, everybody's singing now because they know it. You know. And then he still does it, and it's fun to watch him do it in concert because the entire place sings it back at him.
This break brought to you by Sleep Number. Got to pay the bills. I have a Sleep Number. Did you see my room, by the way? I got a new place. First time you've been to the new place.
I haven't seen the Sleep Number.
Did you give him a tour at all, Mike, or did you walk him up?
We just came up.
Oh. So I have a Sleep Number bed. If you'd like to take a spin and take a nap afterward, feel free. It's a very comfortable bed.
How long is the podcast going to be?
Well,
am I going home tonight?
So listen, Sleep Number, I have one. My Sleep Number setting is 30, and they have a comfort fit pillow, which is awesome now. And you don't realize how awesome pillows are until you actually either have a really bad one or a really good one. And if you have a bad one, you're like, oh, this is terrible. But if you have a good one, you're like, I never even knew I needed a good one. But Sleep Number has the comfort fit pillow, and it remembers even how your head is shaped. And so the comfort fit pillow is comfortable. It's holiday season time, if you're hearing this right recently, and it's there for you. My Sleep Number setting is 30. My sleep IQ score last night was in the 90s, and there's only one place you'll find the Comfort Fit pillow at a Sleep Number store. And right now, you can buy one, get one 50% off, and you can check out the great gifts, too, for greater sleep. 500 Sleep Number stores, 800 Next Bed, and you can tell them that you heard it here on the Bobbycast. That's how you know you start to make it, whenever people want to advertise during your show. I'm a big Sleep Number guy anyway. But whenever we started to get people going, hey, I want to advertise, I'm like, dang,
you've done it.
People are listening to this thing now.
You've done it, right?
So, I'm still a guy. That's your fourth number one. At this point, you're rolling in the dough. I mean, you're walking around, fur coats.
Fur coats come early, though. I mean, you got to jump on that immediately.
Gold chains, whole thing.
Sure.
At this time, they really have to four number ones. Are you a big dog on Music Row?
I don't know. You know, here's the problem. You may not know this because there is no bigger dog than you. But in music, it's like no matter how good you're doing, you've got somebody that's just killing you. You know, so by the time I had four, it's like a couple of my best friends had 12 or something. It's kind of going, this is exhausting. Because here's the thing. It's a numbers game. It's a no game. So I mean, I'm very blessed. So I can't complain about my success. But understand, by the time you get to the fourth number one, I mean, it's thousands of songs, and we write every day, and inevitably the things that you think are your great stuff, nobody cares about. You know, they've passed on them, or you get things on the record, and you're going to be the next single, and then the last minute they change their mind and you don't get it, or the thing comes out, and this is unbelievable. This is huge. This is going to be huge. This is going to be huge. And then the guy loses his record deal. I literally had a single coming out Monday. This was a few years ago. And it was a song that had been cut twice before and had never been a single. And this guy cuts it. He's on a major label. It was the new single. It was in all the trades. They're going for ads on Monday. And on Friday, the guy calls me and he's crying. And he says, I just got dropped. You know. So we do lots of heartbreak, you know, along the way. And you know, so you're constantly, is this the last one? I drive my wife crazy. And all songwriters have it is like, it's a big hit, number one record. I wonder if that's the last one. You know,
it wasn't. Take me to number five.
I guess that was You're Gonna Miss This.
You're gonna miss this, Trace Atkins. You're gonna miss this. Did you write this with Trace?
No, I wrote this with Ashley Gourley.
So did you write in color with Trace?
No. I wrote in
color. You ever write with Trace?
No.
You know, I wonder, because that would be a weird dynamic. That's why I asked, because I got a chance to know Trace. He's a little difficult to have a conversation with. Man of very few words.
He's quiet. Yeah, I mean, he writes. I don't think Trace ever loved writing. You know, I've never written with Trace. I've had a few cuts on Trace. Trace is such a cartoon character because he's so big and his voice is so deep and he's kind of scary, you know.
Yeah, and his stories too. Once you learn them, you get scared even more when he gets shot and you know about his own. Yeah, like he's a bad man.
Yeah, yeah. You never stop thinking about that. You know what's funny is Trace cut in color.
That I think that's where it was. I think in my mind,
Trace cut in color on the same session as You're Gonna Miss This, and. And then Jamie got a record deal that we didn't even know that he was trying to get. And we had to call Trace and tell him he couldn't have in color. I didn't call him. I made somebody else call him.
Both those guys. You don't want to mess with either one of those guys.
Right.
So You're Going to Miss This goes number one.
Yeah.
But this is a monster song, by the way. of all of these songs so far, in my mind, this is the biggest so far as just all-encompassing, everybody knows it. Do you feel that way? Because it's just my personal feeling in my heart. You're
gonna miss I think so. This one song of the year at a couple of things. It was nominated for all the big awards and didn't win any of them. We lost to other things, but yeah, I think that it's certainly for impact. This one is what is used for graduations, and you know, it's done a lot of things.
Until In Color comes along.
Now, interesting thing about In Color. In Color only went to 7.
This wasn't a number one song.
It was not a number one song. It was not a number
one
song.
You know, it's not that. I am shocked by it, but I'm not, because Girl Crush wasn't a number one song. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of huge songs that don't hit number one for whatever political reasons radio has and labels. You know, there's a lot of labels going, okay, we'll trade you this for this. And for some reason, it doesn't happen.
Yeah. Well, and In Color sounded, for all of the things that made people love In Color, it hurt it commercially. If it looks
like. I can't believe this wasn't number one song.
It wasn't. And it took forever to get.
Man, you suck.
I know.
You couldn't even get this song number one.
You wouldn't have done this if you'd have known this didn't go number one. Would you?
This is the only reason I brought him in. This song, though, now is the biggest song of all of them.
I would say this one changed my life more than anything else.
Because,
you know, the music business is an interesting animal. So you can have a big hit on a big commercial cool sounding record that people, the business, just shrugs their shoulders, say, yeah, congratulations, it's a hit.
It's another one. Hey, so, another one.
This one, I don't know, I'm not the one to speak on it. I just know that the things that people said to me, respect wise, craft wise, it got a lot of love, and I had a lot of people say a lot of nice things to me about this.
This is a song that's people's favorite song, and all the other songs, but the Trey song could probably be a favorite song too. Yeah. And the other songs that you had number ones, but those are really fun, good songs. But very few songs in lifetimes are favorite songs of people. Yeah. Because like I have two or three favorite songs in my life, like that's it. Like, what's your favorite song? I got a couple favorite songs. Like, I love Stop This Train from John Mayer. Like, I would say I have a couple favorite songs. If Tomorrow Never Comes, like, I have a couple favorite songs. I know, for example, my manager, Mary Forrest, this is her favorite song in her life. This is me and Grandma. Let's listen to this.
Summer sun all dressed up, the day we said our vows. You can't tell it here, but it was hot that June. That rose was red and her eyes were blue. And just look at that smile. I was so proud. That's the story of mine.
And you're telling me Trace got this first, and you had to call Trace and go, hey, I gotta take it back.
We did. And nobody was really talking about You're Gonna Miss This. It wouldn't have made the record. However, everybody was freaking out about In Color. And I had one of the studio musicians actually called me the day they tracked it. And they tracked both of them. And he says, man, he says, wait till you hear In Color. It is unbelievable. And so the producer called me in to play me the cuts. And he played me You're Gonna Miss This. But I already knew that Trace really didn't like it. Like, he wasn't really into it. And then he played me In Color, Trace's cut. And it killed me. It was big, and it sounded expensive. I mean, it just, wow, is this a big record? And there's rumblings it might be the title track of the album. It's going to be a career record for Trace. And you know, and then he wanted to go do the Celebrity Apprentice, which put the entire album on hold, and they were going to have to do something else. And that gave them just enough hiccup that Jamie the whole time knew he was going to do another record, and so he turned a group of songs in to the label, another label, and they offered him a record deal on the spot. And then they turned around and says, but the easiest thing we think we can get radio to play is In Color. And I said, okay. And so then I walk into the publisher one day, and they said, we got a problem. And they said, they're shipping In Color to radio for Jamie. If it looks like, and I said, Jamie has a deal? They said, yeah. And I said, but we've already promised Trace. And they said, somebody's got to call Trace.
Oh.
And I said, call Jamie. Jamie called Trace.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And he did.
And how was Trace about that? Do you know?
So I hadn't talked to Trace, and it was at the number one party for You're Gonna Miss This. And we're standing on the platform. We'd all done our little speech and our thank yous, and we're having our picture taken, and I'm standing next to Trace, and of course he's 9 feet tall. And I said, I'm sorry about in color. And he goes, yeah. He says, well, he says, if Jamie wasn't a writer on it, it would have been a different story, but
Jamie was a writer on it.
What am I supposed to do?
You wrote it with Jamie.
Yeah, I did. And so we went to Vegas for the ACMs, and when In Color was nominated for Song of the Year, and we won. And so after we go up and we accept our award, we go in the back, and we come back out to go back to our seats and commercial break, and I come walking out through the crowd. And it's fun because it's all Music Row's out there, and everybody's high-fiving you, and, you know. And somebody screams, Lee Miller. And everybody stops and turns around, and Trace is standing up this much taller than everybody else, right, and says, come here. And so I walk over to him, and I kid you not, there I'm in my suit. We're all looking so nice. And he puts me in a headlock. And he screams with vulgarities, that's my blanking song. And I remember I'm standing in a headlock looking at Kid Rock, who's watching me be beat up by Trace Adkins. And then he laughed and he hit me and he said, oh, blank, blank, blank. Congratulations.
So that song also, like, you go to the Grammys for that song, right?
We did. I've had three Grammy nominations, which is beautiful. It just gets you so close to make you want one. What's interesting is In Color was up against You're Gonna Miss This for the Grammy.
You had two songs up for the same Grammy?
I did.
Dang.
And by the time...
It's like royalty in here, dude. I didn't even
by the time I got there, because Impossible is up for a Grammy, but we knew Where Were You When the World Stops Turning. We knew that was going to win, and it did. And then we go for Miss This and In Color, and it's like, okay, well, there's five choices. I have two of them, and a lot of people thought In Color was going to win. So by the time you get down to that and the winner is, I'm pretty pumped. I'm pretty, and I'm dying, so I'm thinking, what are we really going to win a Grammy? And we didn't. Stay, Sugarland. Speaking of Sugarland, they won. And I'm sitting there with Trace, you know, thinking I'm going to win for In Color, and then we didn't win anything.
So Stay, man, Stay's a good song. I'm not going to lie to you. Stay's a good song, too. That's a favorite song for people, too.
I know, but you're my friend, so you shouldn't say that out loud.
I would have voted for In Color, though. That's a life song. They're both great, though. That Stay song. I remember watching a video for that one, being like, oh, my goodness, because Jennifer was crying during the song. I don't know if she was acting, probably because she's a good actor. But
you know what? Actually, at the ACMs, In Color was up against You're Gonna Miss This for Song of the Year at the ACMs. And In Color won Song of the Year, and You're Gonna Miss This won Single of the Year.
So you won both with both of them?
Well, right? The single is for the producer and the artist. But
it's still a you song.
Yeah.
I mean, you wrote the song, and they wanted to produce it or sing it if you didn't write it.
It was pretty fantastic. That was a lot of fun.
It's like all my worlds are colliding because, like, listen, I don't know anything about music, right? I mean, I do whatever I do. But we do our little musical thing and write some songs. But really, the only two people that I feel comfortable writing with that are you and Christian Bush. That's it. Like, that's that. And you guys are up against
each other. Why is that?
Well, I don't let people. You know me. I'm a very private guy when I'm not public.
But you're fun. You're not scary.
I'm not that fun. And I'm not that confident. I can remember the first time because we were like, hey, I didn't know how to do a record. I don't know anything about a record. And it was, hey, you're I'm going to do a comedy record because we had set goals and we said, hey, if we make $1 million for charity, we're going to do a record. And before we could do a record, we had raised $2 million and we're like, holy crap. We kind of owe it to ourselves to at least try. I didn't know any songwriters. I didn't know anything, right? I knew like 5 chords. Now I know like 9. So it's not even that much, that different. And so I'm just writing with a couple of people that I know and by myself and my comedy friend writers where I'm the musical lead, which is not a good place for me to be. So Nick Autry, who's a producer, who's producing the record, who worked at Black River, was like, listen, I've been trying to get this guy for a write. He will not write with me.
He didn't say that.
I swear to God. Lee, I promise. He said he will not write with me. I can't get him for a write. He said, can I use and say you're writing and try to get him to come and do a write? And I was like, I don't care what you do. I don't know anybody. Like, sure, whatever you want to do. And he goes, okay. And I don't even know what the guy's name was, but he told me it was. Anyway, I get there, and it's Lee. I don't know. I didn't know you from gym. I don't know anybody. Like, I really, people think, oh, you must know. I don't know anybody. When it comes to, like, the minutia of what's happening underneath the music, I don't know anybody. I'm starting to meet people now through different processes of touring and writing and not so much radio, but the different parts of it. Like, now I have songwriter friends, and I have a girlfriend who's but then I knew nothing. So all I know is there's a guy named Lee that the producer of the record is like just giddy that he gets to write with them. And I'm like, well, let's see what happens. I don't even know. We wrote the first time we were together.
I like you.
Yeah.
I love baseball. I love Full House.
About my inability to say I love you.
It's disconcerting that you have them queued up that easily. I mean, people think this is like studio tricks where you're doing this later, but you're literally just hitting the button as we talk.
Oh yeah, there's no editing. We don't edit this at all. We don't. It's a roll, right, Mike? Yeah. So we wrote "I Like You" for the Raging Idiots, and then I was like, "Oh, that lead guy's pretty nice." I had no idea what you were. Listen, I didn't know anything. It wasn't a disrespect thing at all. I was clueless. And so Lee leaves, and he was like freaking out. He's like, "We just wrote with Lee Miller." I'm like, "That's amazing." Like, I was like, "That's cool, you know." So cool. Let me go Wikipedia. And I was like, I can't find a Lee Miller anywhere. Because I know it was Lee Thomas Miller that was your writing name. I was like, this guy probably, why do you want to write with him? He didn't have any songs. Lee Miller? Like, Lee, is that Arthur Miller's brother from back in the 50s? You know, I didn't know what the deal was, right? So he was like, no.
I thought you had done the Google before we wrote. Now I just feel weird.
Well, I didn't know anything. It was just ignorance. So the second time I was ready, though. Second time he said, I'm going to ask Lee to write again. I'm like, cool. Ask Lee to write again. I thought we were friendly and we hit it off. Which I don't hit it off a lot of people because I'm very reserved and shy to a point where sometimes people think I'm rude. But I just am very introverted when I'm not extroverted. So I was like, yeah, I like Lee. I felt like I could make jokes and I thought you were funny. And so I said, yeah, bring him back in. And so we went in and we started playing this song. And we're like, hey, let's write a song about Starbucks, right? And so
Starbucks,
this isn't how it started. It started with two guitars.
Oh, it didn't sound anything like this.
And it was a country song where we were, you know, singing it. And I was like, hey, Lee, play a little faster. Let me try to rap this thing. And Lee's like, you rap? I was like, let's just see what happens here. So Lee, like, boom, the bass starts popping it like this.
Was I popping it?
Yeah, you're popping it pretty hard. He was hitting it with, and so it was written on two acoustics. And the next thing you know, we have this ridiculous song that, by the way, it's so weird to have people sing this song back, but our band, The Raging Idiots, has a song, Starbucks, and there's Lee.
Starbucks be filling up my cup. Starbucks be jacking me up. Starbucks, 10,000 degrees. And yeah, I'll take a Danish, I need something to eat. I'm always holding up the line because I might be a little choosy, and I do appreciate the fact you use a paper koozie.
How's that not nominated for a Grammy?
Nick did good. That's great production.
Oh, yeah, the one of the most fantastic pieces of writing I've ever heard, and production, and vocals. I mean, it's all right there.
I'm proud of that.
No, you shouldn't be. But here's a funny story. So we're playing the Ryman last year for the Million Dollar Show, and this is a show for St. Jude, and I invite a ton of people out to play with us. And so it's our band, The Raging Idiots, but all show long, it's Little Big Town, it's Kelsey, it's people that I'm friends with that are coming on to also raise money for St. Jude, but they were easy calls for me because I don't like asking people to do stuff. But when it comes to charity, I'll ask my friends to do stuff. And I'll be like, so, you know, I called Little Big Town, and I called Kelsey, and I called
Carrie,
who all these people were just fantastic to show up. And at the end of it, we played, during this Raging Idiot show, we played Starbucks and I Like You, and Lee and his wife came. And I was like, hey, Lee, stay. You know, there's like one, but I want to hang out. Because I like Lee, Mike. I don't know if you know, but genuinely, I like Lee.
That's where you met my wife, actually.
It was, for the first time. And so I was being funny. I made a joke. I said, hey, dude, congratulations. You got two songs played at the Ryman tonight. He goes, no, I got three. And I was like, dude, did we play something else that you wrote? He's like, no. Chris Stapleton had showed up, and we invited him. He was a secret guest. And Chris, again, I just made a call. Because with the Chris thing, like we had Chris in before that his Traveler ever came out. I was just a big fan of Chris as a songwriter and as a vocalist. So Chris was just grateful and still is very loyal to this day and don't do anything because he's like, hey, I just appreciate you like being there for me when it wasn't Chris Stapleton.
Yeah.
And so Chris comes, and at this time he had blown up. And he shows up and the crowd's going crazy. And he plays Whiskey and You, right?
That's the difference. Between Whiskey and You.
And Lee goes, oh yeah, I wrote Whiskey and You with Chris. And I was like, ah, oh, got me.
It was so poser for me to say that, wasn't it?
No, I set myself up.
But you had to know.
I didn't know. I set myself up and got punched right in the nads. Like, I was like, hey, you got to feel good, dude. And he's like, no, three. And the good one. I wrote the good one, Whiskey and You.
I didn't say that.
In my heart, you did.
Hills,
so you write this with Chris?
I did.
And one's long gone, bitch.
That's such a good song.
And I told him a couple years ago, I said, because this has been cut several times before Chris put Traveler out. And McGraw cut it for one. And I think Aaron Lewis has cut it. And I said, I'll tell you what. Is this line in? This is, I drink because I'm lonely, and I'm lonely because I drink. And I said, if it's ever a hit, I will get that tattooed somewhere. And he says, okay. He says, how about this? The higher the hit on the charts, the more visible the tattoo. So it hasn't been on the charts yet, so it's pending.
It's one of those songs that's an album cut. And again, you always want the single because that's how a songwriter makes money.
Sure.
But that's one of the album cuts on records that people know. Because most of the time you don't know album cuts.
It's funny. A lot of people know this.
Yeah. But that whole album is so good from front to back that a lot of those songs are so well known.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you write that with Chris. And those other people cut it first. I had no idea.
You know, Chris is incredibly successful as a songwriter, and the whole time, I mean, it wasn't like he just all of a sudden become incredible. I mean, we've all known it forever. We wrote at the same company for a long time, and I spent a lot of time with Chris, and I wrote every other Wednesday with Chris for years. And so once he got his record deal, and, you know, immediately, and he's had a record deal for a while. It takes a while for things to happen. And, you know, I've been telling him now for years, you know, at least 3 years or something since he's been out, you know, being an artist and traveling. And about every 2 months, I'll just text him and say, I miss my every other Wednesday. Because it was like, you just knew. I mean, sometimes we wrote just commercial ditty, and sometimes we wrote dark and sad. But whatever it was always so good. Like, we had, me and Chris wrote Thomas Rhett's first single with him, and Thomas was still in college.
What song is that?
Something to do with my hands.
Oh, cool. So maybe
unbelievable. You're a pro.
So you and Stapleton write this for Thomas.
He was still in college.
Yeah.
It's funny because the other day I saw Thomas and I said, I need to update my contacts because I went to email you something the other day and it's still your college.ed at whatever it is address. You know? So he would like, you know, come write with us in the morning and then go do afternoon classes.
Good dude.
Good dude.
Yeah, I like Thomas a lot. Yeah, he's a good dude. He's the next superstar.
Oh, sure he is.
And has earned it, not been thrown up there. Yep. Like, he's taken all the right steps.
Yep. And did it his own way.
And I like him a lot.
Wonderful.
So you and Stapleton wrote that for Thomas.
You did.
Let me ask you about one more number one you had here. Tim McGraw, Southern Girl. So you write this with who?
Rodney Clausen and Jaron Johnston.
Jaron, by the way, Cadillac 3.
Yes.
Yeah. And also, Cadillac 3, but a very prominent songwriter.
Absolutely.
Too. Like, maybe even bigger songwriter, because Cadillac 3, as good as they are, they haven't really cut through commercially yet.
Yep.
Songwriter, like, one of the real elite guys.
Yep, sure is.
That band is so good, too. They just haven't had the right song.
Sure.
Right. So you guys write this, and so do you pitch it to McGraw first, or does it go around?
I think he was the first person that heard it. I think that he was looking, you know. And you know, Tim's been good to all of us, and we sent it over, and they loved it, and they cut it. And There you go.
Probably taught her how a lady should.
See, that's the opposite of the impossible. Like, that story is the polar opposite of the impossible.
It is. And you know what's funny, though? People love this song. It's like you can kind of gauge at writer's nights when I do them, you know, the popularity of things and how much people love them, how much they sing.
You're so good at writer's nights that it's really bad. Because I played one with Lee once. It was awful. It was really one of the worst performing experiences of my life. And I've had a couple really bad ones. But Lee says, hey, will you play Tin Pan South? Right? Yes. Maybe the first time I got it right. I'm not in the writer world.
You had no idea.
No, I know. I was like, Tin Pan South, sure, what is that? Like, everybody bring pots, pans?
Well, I understand.
Play in the kitchen?
Bobby famously says that. I don't know people. I don't know, you know. And somebody at the Nashville Songwriters Association, who puts on Tin Pan South as their big fundraiser, said, do you think Bobby would play Tin Pan South with you? And I said...
So they came to you.
Well, it was just kind of a candid thing. Do you think Bobby would do it? And I said, no. And then, okay, well, I thought I'd ask. And so then I stood there and I was like, I said, wow. I said, that would be a really good one because people would like to see him. I said, okay, I'll ask, but there's no way. And so I just texted him and I just said, hey, would you do Tin Pan South? And I gave him a date, or the dates, the week. And he writes right back, sure. And I said, wait.
I didn't know what it was. All I knew was my friend, and again, maybe three people could have asked me that question. And two of them I'd have said maybe to, and one of them I would have said yes to. And the yes was Lee. I don't know what it was. I thought it was like a...
But you said yes immediately, so I knew you didn't know what it was.
I had no idea. But you were asking me the same way that I will make the call to close friends, and they say yes before I can really explain what it is. Like, I was like, yes.
Well, immediately there was pressure because I'm like, okay, wait, is he just doing this because I asked? Because I don't know that we're close enough that would he do that? So I said, wait, I don't think you know what this is. And he says, I'll do it if you want me to. And I said, okay, it's going to be me and you and two other guys. We're going to sit on stools. We're going to take turns. And for 2 hours, we're going to play songs and tell the story behind the song. And it's light and it's loose, but there'll be a big crowd, and it's a songwriter's night. And his quote was, I literally bring nothing to the table, but I will if you want me to. And so now I'm like, I'm flattered and I'm terrified because that's a lot of pressure in case he hates this, right?
On the opposite, I'm terrified, and then I'm flattered in the opposite order.
Well, you did it, and it was amazing.
It wasn't
amazing.
First of all, this is the awful thing. So Lee is first, and usually I'm the funny guy, and then I do the bad music stuff. Lee's also the funny guy, and he does great. He's nailing all these number one songs. And then I have to go, and I'm not even the funny guy, nor am I the music guy. And so I'm like, oh, great. I have to follow freaking Lee again. And so all night long, I'm following Lee. But the two guys that he mentions are two of the bigger songwriters in all of country music right now, Ashley Gourley and Chris DiStefano, who have number one, number one, number one, like crazy. And so it's me and three humongous songwriters, and they're up there just blasting out their hits. And I'm like, Starbucks, filling up my cup. I was just like, what? And this is what I was told, too. He was like, well, you know, we'll play 4 or 5 songs. That's it. I was like, great. So I prepared 4 or 5 songs, and we ended up going 7 deep.
No, we did.
Yo, we went way deep. And I was like, at one point, I was like, I don't know what else I can play. Like, I don't know that many songs. Like, I know parts of songs. I know how to sing songs. But I'm supposed to do them all. But yes, that was just, you're asking? Yes, I will do it. And then I figured it out. And I'm much better. I learned a lot from that experience.
Really? Like what?
How to handle that situation and how to get to that level where I can do it again and not feel so foolish. I'm never going to be good. I know my limitations in life, but it's where can you find things that take those limitations and kind of rise above? And first of all, I know more songs. Secondly, I know my role. If I'm ever playing with you, first of all, I'm not playing beside you. I'm going to play in front of you, or I'm going to play like 3 people down. I'm not playing beside you. So I also learned how to do a writer's round. I've never done a writer's round before that.
So you want to do them again? Is that what you're saying?
I didn't say I want to, but if you need me, I would do it in a second. But to go from not doing one to doing that one would be comparable to moving to Nashville, just learning how to play the guitar, and me going, hey, come play on our radio show for 5 million people. Like, that was kind of – and it was really weird. And I felt foolish after it was over. But – Everybody was happy, right?
I think all the people came to see you,
they did
so I
not.
Think it was fine.
They did not. Chris DiStefano sings as good as any artist out there just about. And he's just like nailing. He was doing Carrie, Something in the Water, which he wrote. And it's just like he's singing it as loud and as pure as it can possibly be sang. And I'm just like.
And DiStefano finishes Something in the Water and the people go crazy and then the crowd dies down. And Bobby says, how much money do you have in your wallet right now? See, that was
that's
funny.
But that's what they wanted to know. Like, people always want to know that stuff. And so I'm like, okay, I'm just going to be me. And I'm going to ask questions that are coming to my head because I got to know. You wrote that song. How much is your wallet right this second? Like, how much cash are you holding? And he kind of danced around the question. But I asked.
He didn't answer.
He didn't answer. No, it's okay. And you don't always have to answer. But I have to ask. So, yeah, that was a fun night. You are writing, and you have been writing with some of my friends, Brothers Osborne.
Yes.
Those are my dudes.
Oh.
They're so far my dudes that John's wife is like, Lucy Silvas, is like one of my favorite artists
She's
in the world.
She's amazing.
Too. So, yes. You and Brothers Osborne, I have It Ain't My Fault up here. So you guys wrote this together.
We did.
Yeah.
But it ain't my fault.
I love this song.
No, it ain't my fault. Might have had a little fun, not a wrong job done.
What do you think of those guys?
Well, in my head, I sing like him. They're wonderful. They're so fun to work with. They're so fun to write with. I mean, I can't. I think they're one of the next big things. It was so exciting. They won Song of the Year at ASCAP, which I knew was going to happen, and I'd been sworn to secrecy. And they announced it, and they just lost their minds in this beautiful.
They were also kind of drunk by
emotional,
then.
Emotional. Maybe it helped.
I mean, no, and they were very emotional about it because they really were. Like, they were moved.
Oh, very
moved. Very moved.
Everything they said was so pure. And then at the CMAs, they won Duo. And I mean, you know, we were there, me and my wife, and you're all dressed up and you're sitting at Bridgestone, you're watching it, and probably not going to be shocked by a whole lot. So you just kind of say, and all of a sudden they win. And I was like, I'm throwing popcorn and I'm screaming and I'm dancing and I'm flailing. And everybody was, it's one of those things where I was like, these are such good guys. It was such a great moment.
Everyone expected Florida Georgia Line to win again. And they didn't. And it was a double shock. One, that Florida Georgia Line didn't win. Two, that Brothers Osborne won. And not the Brothers Osborne didn't deserve it, but nobody was predicting that.
Well, and understand, this wasn't anything against Florida Georgia Line. It's just they're at their peak. I mean, clearly, they're killing it, and anyone else would have been an underdog. And for Brothers Osborne to win was exciting, but also because everyone that has experienced these guys just love them. They're wonderful musicians, and they're just sweethearts.
Yeah, John plays the guitar like
it's amazing,
a maniac. And I see great guitar players, and he plays like a maniac. I'll disagree with you a bit. I think they're very deserving. I think a part of it was anti-Florida Georgia Line. I do. Not that they're not – and I say that as – like I know Brothers Osborne's parents. Like that's how
– I do too.
I was so happy for them. I think a little bit of that sentiment wasn't even about Florida Georgia Line. It was that type of music. It was like we want there to be a slight change.
Maybe.
And they've also won it X amount of years in a row. Who is awesome, and we want to kind of make a slight change. And I think that was a part of it. I don't think it was the majority of it, but if I didn't say that some of that was anti-Florida Georgia Line, I would be lying. But that's just my opinion.
Right.
So I was pumped for them. Like, I was going crazy. And I was watching the Cubs play. I didn't even go to the CMAs. I like, screw the CMAs. First of all, screw the CMA anyway. But then that's me saying that, not you. But then
that's Bobby saying
that.
Yeah,
it's for sure
me.
Screw the CMA. But I didn't go to the CMAs. I came home to watch the Cubs play. And I flipped over for that because when your friends play, you want to watch. And because Lindsay played too, she played with Carrie that night.
Yes.
And so there were things I was flipping over for to catch. But yeah, that was cool. That was really cool for those guys.
She was part of the whole wild girl rock band part of the evening. Your girlfriend was.
Yeah. Yeah, I was proud of her.
I tried to get you to come to a cocktail party during awards week too, and you wouldn't come because of the Cubs.
Yeah. I mean.
And it was a cocktail party.
More because it was the Cubs, and I don't do weeknights at all, like zero weeknights. Although last night I was doing a Cracker Barrel commercial till probably 11 o'clock.
You had dinner at my house on a weeknight.
I did, and it was really late. And I felt like you wanted us to leave because you unbuttoned your top button, and you started to look a little disheveled?
See, you keep telling that, and at some point, I'm going to be like slumped over in a chair the farther the story goes.
I have had zero dinners with people, let me think. I really can think of none. It's just not my thing. Zero dinners. And Lee was like, come down for dinner. And I was like, I'm coming down for dinner. He invited me. First of all, I was by myself. He was like, hey, come down.
My wife asked you.
Yes.
My wife at 10 Pan South says, I want you to come to my house for dinner like normal people.
And I said, I'm not a normal person.
But you said yes. We just had never scheduled it. You had never committed.
And I didn't want to be the third wheel. There's a husband, wife, and me. When I got a girlfriend, I was like, I'm in for dinner, Lee. And so then we couldn't find a date. And I was like, okay, we'll just figure it out some other time. And Lee was like, no. So we negotiated for about 20 minutes on dates. And then went down and we had dinner until like 10 o'clock. It was really a wonderful time. And my girlfriend really liked you guys. So
I did not get tired. I said, okay, we stood up. We walked around the house. And we come back, and the girls sat back down and continued talking, so I sit down. And you took that to mean I was tired. I never remember touching my
and
shirt.
And your top button. Yeah. Okay, listen, in my mind, things happen. But that was the only dinner I think I've ever... Mike, you think we go to a dinner?
I don't think so.
On a weeknight? Ever?
No.
Yeah, me either. Man.
He sat at a table with children, and we talked about life and
part of that's
weather
also
and,
a girlfriend, too. Like...
She's a great girlfriend, too. She's a good hang.
She makes me a normal human a little more than I am.
Yeah.
Because she's oddly...
She fills in your awkward silences.
Which is all. It's all one big awkward silence.
Which means
me.
She talks and you just kind of sit and hang.
Yeah. So that was good. Frankie Ballard wrote El Camino.
Yes. Which is Stapleton.
So you and Chris wrote El Camino, too.
We did.
This is the title track, too, right? Of that record? Is that record called El Camino or is it called like El Paso? Or?
No, it's called No, it's not the title track.
It's not. Is it something? But it ain't my fault. Dude, I think we're shorting out over here, dude.
Is it?
Yeah. Here's, so get me a dog. There's like a whatever the name of it is. It's something.
It's like a name of a Texas town.
Yeah, it's
like,
okay. That may be why I think it's El Camino.
El Rio or something.
So you guys ride El Camino? Just you two?
We did.
Dang, I need to get out. And I don't want to say any names, but what I want to get into once, I'm just asking you this favor. We ask favors of each other. Whenever you get like a really powerful right, I want to sit in the room and add like a couple words. And let me get a third of that right.
You do?
Yeah. It'll legitimize me.
Because nobody's ever thought about that before.
That happens, right? Does that happen?
I hear that it does.
Oh, see, I will be so upset with that. I wouldn't be able to handle that very well.
It's funny. I remember when I started, it was a three-way was kind of taboo. You needed it to be no more than two.
Really?
Yeah, I remember that. I remember there were people that wouldn't do a three-way.
That's crazy now because I know most rights are three people, or at least a lot of them are now.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also less money if it hits. That's dividing in threes.
Simple math.
So you and Chris write every other Wednesday.
We did.
And in these, you wrote all these songs? Like Whiskey and You on these every other Wednesday.
Okay. I probably had more cuts with Chris than I have had with anybody.
And he's a good dude, huh?
Wonderful.
What I know of him, and I feel like I know him relatively well for how the time we spent together, just because he's been great to me, and I was such a... I'm just a fan of him as a writer. And I've been lucky enough to do on the radio show, be fans of writers, and talk about writers, and bring writers in, and Chris was one of those guys.
Chris is quiet, and I think that before he got married, I felt like he's kind of got a dark side. I feel like that when he married Morgan, I think that rounded him out, and I think that took the dark away. I think he's a happy person. He's a wonderful father. As I've already said, I've been in this town a long time. I know a lot of musicians. Chris Stapleton's the most talented person I've ever worked with, and always. And that was before the world ever knew about him. He's the second, next to Bobby Bones. He's the most talented person.
I know, I just have my throat. I was just coughing.
I am so embarrassed. You can edit that out later.
As a writer, you wrote today, right, before you came over here?
I did.
Okay, is that every day? Do you drive somewhere and write every day?
Every day. Drive downtown. Because I love Music Row. I love driving into Music Row and... Drives my wife crazy. She says, you have a great space at home. Why don't you write here? And I was like, because I like to go to Music Row and work.
Every day.
Every day.
Seems like it would be exhausting.
Every day.
Who do you like now? And not who do you not like, but give me a couple people that you hear now that you hear on the radio. Maybe you don't have any relationship with them at all, and you're like, that's cool. I like that.
Like
that you don't have a personal relationship with. Like, we can't say Brothers Osborne. We both enjoy them as humans. Can't mention them. But you hear something on the radio, and you're like, that's pretty cool.
Well, you know what? I have never had a Kenny Chesney cut, and I am a Kenny Chesney fan. I love Setting the World on Fire.
I was talking to Kenny. We were, man, I didn't know. He didn't tell me. See, here's the thing about it. Have you say you never met Kenny?
I've met him. I've said hi.
But you haven't hung
out. I don't
out.
Know him. I've never hung.
I'm going to give you a couple of Kenny stories. So I have hung with him a few times. My work, it creates that atmosphere, and then if you actually get along with someone, you can still sit in the same room. And if you don't, you go back to your own rooms. And sometimes our artists and I, we just go back to our own rooms. It's like humans. Not all humans mesh, right? Kenny and I, for some reason, get along. But Kenny has no filter. And I wouldn't have no filter around someone that had a big microphone.
Sure.
But I keep a lot of secrets, too. I'm good at that. Like, I know the difference what I can and can't say. I wouldn't trust me until I was able to trust me. He's always trusting me for some reason. So Kenny and I, just the last time we were together, we're up, we're on stage, and we've had three or four instances where we've been together for over an hour and a half or so. So we're comfortable with each other. And we're playing songs from his record, and there's a crowd watching, and that song that you like, and that I like too, it's an amazing song with Pink. What a great person to pick for that song, Setting the World on Fire. He leans over and he goes, this was never going to be a single ever. And I was like, why would you cut it with a pop artist? You know, why? And he's like, I wanted it to be, but had she not gotten pregnant, this would never have been a single because she was doing her own thing and they were going to let us put it out because she'd had her songs out. You can't put a song out. I didn't know she hadn't announced that she was pregnant. He told me this.
Oh, this is
like
fantastic.
A month before she had, because she just announced she was pregnant like a week or so ago as we're taping this right now. She just said she was pregnant. And I was like, oh my God. He never said don't say anything about it. I never did.
Oh, that could have been a mess.
But it could have been a mess.
That's
because
a lot of pressure.
He just threw it out there like, oh yeah, wow. She was pregnant. And had she not gotten pregnant, we'd have never got to cut this song. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. Had it come up in conversation, I may have said something about it because he didn't say, hey, don't, off the record, hey, don't say this. So that song would have never been on the radio. It was never, when they cut it, it was never going to be on the radio. But because she got pregnant, I was like, I'm going to pull myself off. They got to put it out as a single. So I thought that was pretty cool. There was another one, because he just says stuff, and you're like, did you say that? And like, I have another good kid. What's
it's
my
very
other
trusting.
But why, I don't know why he would trust me, though, of all people. Because I'm known, because I don't have a big mouth, but I say my feelings, and those two things kind of get mixed up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was dicey. You could have messed up because you could have just assumed that everybody knew.
I did assume that. It just didn't come up in a conversation because I would
have. You got lucky on that one.
I would have said something. Man, I had another good Kenny story too from that night, but I don't know. I forgot it. Who knows? I've been talking on today for like 11 hours.
I dig Maren Morris.
Yeah, Maren's awesome, huh?
Yeah. I think she's very real. I met her, again, before Chris blew up. I was on the road riding with him, and she opened a show for him at this little bar in Atlanta, and the first time I ever seen her, and she just was so amazing. She was so sweet. And then it's funny, last summer vacation, family vacation, I'd taken my oldest, just me and him, to the Rock and Roll Museum in Cleveland, and we're sitting in the cafe eating a sandwich at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, random, and Maren Morris walks in and sits down and eats a salad, and I said, what are you doing? And she was in town with the Keith Urban concert, and she was just going through the Hall of Fame. And it's funny, now she probably couldn't walk through there, everybody'd go crazy. But
you know, I think the weird thing about Maren, and I know I've the same way, you know, Maren and I were cool before Maren blew up, and I had her on the show before she had anything to download, just because I thought, man, she's really good.
Yeah.
And so she still goes to Walmart and stuff.
Yeah,
like she,
that's part of Nashville too. I think you can get away with stuff in Nashville that maybe you can't some places. People
I think
people
if people go, this
along.
Is Maren Morris, everybody freaks out.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's, and Maren's real deal.
Yeah. She's going to be pretty recognizable though. I mean, she's going to be hard, you know.
Yeah.
If you're a fan, you're going to, oh, that's her.
She's also going to be the new, and she already kind of is, because her record was so critically acclaimed because it was so good. Sometimes records get big because they're just big, they're big on the radio. But her record was critically acclaimed because it was so good. And like My Church wasn't a number one song. Mm-hmm. And 80s Mercedes probably isn't going to be a number one song. But the record is so good. Like it doesn't matter. Yep. It's like when we go back to, you know, talking about In Color. Like you don't even know. Remember what was number one?
Well, my daughters know every song on that record. Every word of every song.
Yeah, me too. And I don't listen to records. Mm-hmm. I just don't. No, I mean, really? Nobody does anymore, unless it's your favorite artist.
I think that's sad.
Yeah, but it's also that it's a generational thing.
I know.
Because we're able to get music one at a time. When I was young, you didn't get music one at a time unless you went to the store and bought the single on tape, and there was another side of it, too. Mm-hmm. And that was when I was young. But if you give someone the option to not buy 13 songs, we're not. We're going to buy them one at a time of what we like. Oh, do we like the next one? Oh, do we like the next one? Oh, we like the next one?
Sure.
And so you end up not buying every song. Unless it's your favorite artist. But Maren's record, yeah, I know all the songs too. She's fantastic. She also is one of those artists too. We have a pretty good text relation. I just have text. That's who I talk. I talk to everybody text. I don't like talking on the phone. I don't even talk to Lindsay on the phone. It's FaceTime or it's I'll see you at the, you know, wherever. But Maren's so cool. Like, hey, I appreciate you not coddling me ever. I appreciate you, like, because she's real. Like, as real as she seems, yeah. That's her. Well, let me see if there's anything else up here. How about a little With His Hands, Ken Melons?
And he built mansions.
What do you know about this? Do you like this one?
That's one of my first cuts ever. That's like 1994.
Yeah? He'll never be a lawyer?
He'll never be a lawyer because he can't pass a
come on. I think that might have been my first cut ever.
He'll never be a lawyer.
What movie star, but he'll never be a lawyer because he can't pass a bar.
Come on. Is that coming back? Is that sound coming back?
That's funny. For some, my theory is, and what's happening with the format musically is, country, first of all, is getting so big that it's going to turn into what Top 40 is. Now, not a style because Top 40 is always evolving. But what it's going to happen is country, as Top 40 has done. Top 40 has the couple best pop songs, well, the couple best hip-hop songs, the couple best rock songs, and that's the mesh that is Top 40. Country's going to be the same way. You're going to have a couple of the best guys that sound classic, the classic country sound. You're going to have a couple of the guys that sound way progressive, like the Sams of the world. You're going to have a couple of the females, and they're going to be all these little lanes, and it's going to be the top couple to three of each lane is going to be what makes it onto the country radio
format.
We've been
predicting that for a while.
No, like, but it's happening now.
Splitting the format.
Well, they're not going to split it right now. They've split it into two in the last few years of older, mm-hmm. with the Legends and Icon brand. They have older stations. And what's funny is older stations are awesome. Like, mm-hmm. it's like the good stuff, you know, the 90s stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not even like the 50s stuff because they had classic country stations. But now these older stations are 90s and some 80s and a little early 2000s. And those are like my favorite of the stations. I'm going to be honest.
Do you have my Randy Travis cut on there?
Yeah. Here it is. Hold on. Here's Lee's Randy Travis cut. You want to set it up?
It's one of the only ones I ever heard that when they called me into the label to play it for me.
Starbucks be filling up my cup. Starbucks be jacking me up.
I was going to say it made me cry when I heard it. You know,
what's the Randy? You know what? You stumped us.
I stump you?
Yeah, you did.
The Family Bible and the Farmer's Almanac.
I don't have that one.
It's my only Randy Travis cut, but ooh, I got one.
My Elvis, my grandma's favorite artist. Oh, Randy Travis, good. Johnny Cash, because he was from Arkansas. So this is what rubbed off on me. You know, what your parents listen to, and I have a strong parental system, so my grandma did a lot of the raising of me. And so my grandma was my mom, basically. Even adopted me for a while as a kid. But it was Johnny Cash. He was from Arkansas. And if you're from Arkansas, people from Arkansas that make it, they're your heroes. So it was Johnny. And she would tell me stories about how people would protest Johnny Cash, because that's not country. That's rock and roll. And people would be out just furious. It just reminds me of what people are doing on blogs now about what's happening in country music.
Yeah.
Everything's cyclical, sure. Everything constantly. Sure. That, Randy Travis, Ray Charles, and Andy Griffith gospel albums. I mean, as I listen to all that. I hear it, and it makes me love my grandma so much. But that's then great. I just remember being so just annoyed. Like, can we please listen to something else? And
that's
great. On records. But now I appreciate it. Then I was like, is this all we got?
You know, I was a teenager through all the great 80s music, all that great 80s pop music, and I was listening to Gene Watson and Alabama, and even now we'll be somewhere and some, you know, amazing song from 1985 will come on somewhere in some Prince song or some band that I've never even heard of. There was a huge hit, and my wife will know every word, and she'll say, "Do you seriously not know this song?" And she'll, "This was probably the theme to your prom." And I'm like, "I was listening to Gene Watson, babe. I'm sorry."
So, just to recap, you have lots of good songs, and you're pretty funny.
You did a lot of show prep, too. I'm impressed.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing I do. This is like my profession. You know how you write songs today?
Yeah.
That's what you do? That's kind of what I do.
You look tired when I came in.
I'm tired all the time. When have I ever not looked tired?
How are you tired all the time, but you never sleep? Is there any way these are combined?
Yes, that's why I'm always tired. Oh.
You'll text me at 10 o'clock, and I'm like, you've got to get up like now.
Yeah. But if I didn't do what I loved, I wouldn't be able to do it like this. I love what I do. Just like you love what you do.
Why were you dressed like an elf last week?
I wasn't, was I? Was I dressed like an elf last week?
For something. You were somewhere doing a...
Sure it wasn't like a Brad Pitt Us Weekly cover or something?
It was either you or Brad Pitt dressed like an elf doing something in somewhere because you're gone all the time. You were because you sent me back something funny about being an elf. I don't know. That was a lot of days ago.
Well, I appreciate you coming in and sharing your stories. They're good ones.
Are they good?
Yeah, they're good. My favorite one you didn't tell. I want you to tell this one. And if a normal story is 100%, tell this at 120% rate because we're running out of time. You go up.
Does that mean tell it fast?
No. And I don't even want to give any sort of spoiler here. But tell the story about how the soup. I'll just say the soup and let you tell the story.
The Soup?
Yeah, the TV show, The Soup. When they make fun of you.
Oh, so we get to our seats at the ACM Awards. I was so thinking we might win because, again, I had two songs up for Song of the Year at the ACMs in Vegas. And I get to my seat, and we're on the 20th row in the middle, right? And Talk Soup, that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right? And
oh, yeah, it's not called The Soup. It used to be called Talk Soup.
Okay, yeah. So... I'm like, we're not going to win. There's no way we're going to win because there's no way they would put the winner here because it's terrible seats, right? And I'm bummed, and I'm like, this is so depressing. And I'd kind of work through my mind because I always like to be prepared. I'm not afraid to do public speaking, but I need to know what I'm going to say, and just in case I win. So then Jennifer Love Hewitt is giving the award away, and she calls our name, and we won. In Color won Song of the Year. And she calls my name, and I run, you know, I go down there, and I'm so pumped, I'm so excited, and I'm so nervous. And I'm on stage, and I'm standing next to Jennifer Love Hewitt, and Jamie Johnson does his little spiel. And usually they don't give you much time, but they let Jamie speak, and then they let James speak. And so then I step up, and in front of all the world on national television, I said, I want to thank my wife. I want to thank my kids. Levi, Noah, Levi. No, that's not right. Everybody laughs. So then I continued my speech. I walk off stage. I'm nervous. I'm freaking out. And the next morning, the Soup people were doing the Yahoo Entertainment Clip of the Week. And it was like 8:30 the next morning. It's everywhere, right? Country Music Awards were held last night in Las Vegas, Nevada. Check this guy out. It's me. I want to thank my wife. I want to thank my kids, Levi, Noah, Levi. No, that's not right. This guy is so country. He has not one, but two kids named Levi.
Thank you. Mike, any questions before we jump?
That was awesome, man. I think I'm good.
You good?
Yeah.
All of it squeezed out?
Yeah, I learned a lot.
Lee Thomas Miller. That's his name. I just call him, hey, dude.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Thanks for the stories. All right, so that's episode 25. Thanks for hanging out here on the Bobbycast. Hope you learned a little something, and we'll see you guys next time. Thanks, guys.